Good morning. It's 10 minutes after 8 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm here today filling in for Joy Cardine. It seems like a long time ago now, back in 2000, when Al Gore and George Bush were running for the White House, and the election came down to the Electoral College votes for Florida. So, even though Gore collected more votes from citizens, Bush received more Electoral College votes and the White House as a result. Back then, a lot of people started paying attention to the Electoral College, many of them probably for the first time since they learned about it in civics or government classes in high school or college. Our guest this hour is David Sirota. He is a former campaign strategist and author of Hostile Takeover, How Big Business Took Over Our Government and How We Can Take It Back. He wrote a recent syndicated column called The Path to a National Popular Vote, and that's what we'll be talking about this hour. His next book, by the way, The Uprising, is going to be published in May of 2008. We'd like to hear what you think about the idea of a popular vote. For many, the 2000 election is a symbol of everything that is wrong with the Electoral College system. And what is it a symbol of to you? Call with your comments and your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you can also use our local number if you're calling from the Madison area. It is 263-1890. And of course, email works as well. That address is talk@wpr.org. David Sirota, good morning and welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as you know, we are in Wisconsin, which means by virtue of that we are close to Iowa, which means that we have been inundated with the past few months about news of what's happening in Iowa as campaigns are stopping at every little diner and every little crossroads that they can. Here in Wisconsin, though, we don't get to vote for a presidential primary contender until February 18th. And by then, many people think that it'll be a done deal. And that really is kind of the premise of where your column starts, The Path to a National Popular Vote. And I'm wondering if you could maybe start out by talking about what inspired you to write this particular column.
Well, what inspired me is that, you know, I live right now in Colorado, mm-hmm. which, like Wisconsin, is a general election swing state. But obviously, in the primary process, with so much focus on Iowa and New Hampshire, our state is basically left out. It's not exact. I shouldn't say it's left out because we're voting on February 5th in the primaries. But it's certainly people are asking why do Iowa and New Hampshire get such such a huge say in national politics, such a disproportionate say. And so I decided to take the time to write a column about, you know, how do we avoid this in the next phase of the election, in the general election, because the same phenomenon happens, right? You know, the presidential campaigns spend most of their money in a few select states, and much of the country is basically left out of the presidential election. Now, Wisconsin and Colorado, for instance, tend to benefit from being presidential general election swing states. But other states, you know, I used to live in Montana. Montana has been a solidly Republican state in presidential elections and therefore is basically ignored during presidential elections. And there are many, many states like that across the country. And as I say in the column, that's by virtue of the Electoral College. What we have is in the winner-take-all Electoral College system, If you win what's considered comfortably by 55% of a statewide vote, you get all of that state's electors. And so what that ends up doing is it makes the only states that are really important are the ones that whose statewide decision is really in question, where you know states can be decided by 51-52% of the vote. And what that does is that means that you know states where a candidate may get 45% of the vote, which is substantial number of votes, those 45% of people are basically, you know, their votes don't really count because the Electoral College has, again, this winner-take-all system. So what I talk about in the column is how do we actually get to a national popular vote where the Electoral College isn't used to basically make the presidential election take place only in a few states, and whereby, where you live doesn't impact how important your vote is. And finally, to prevent the situation where somebody who loses the national popular vote can win the presidential election in the Electoral College. That's the fundamental problem, of course, of the Electoral College. Somebody who loses the election can actually become president, as we saw in 2000. And so my column goes through and says how we can actually do this. And, you know, people have tend to thought that we needed a constitutional amendment to do this because the Electoral College is in the Constitution. But actually, there's a pretty easy way to do this via state legislatures. What would happen is that a state legislature would say, we will give our electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote. We will not apportion them necessarily on who wins this individual state. And the key for this is that this plan would only go into effect when enough states representing a majority of the Electoral College vote signed on to this compact. So that would mean that it would be guaranteed that whoever won the national popular vote would automatically get the majority of Electoral College votes, thus making the presidential election a national popular vote.
Why is now the time? I mean, after 2000, I think a lot of people, at least average people, discovered the Electoral College for the first time since they'd heard about it back in school. But why 8 years down the road are we taking a look at this again?
Well, I think people remember the 2000 election where George Bush won the presidency and didn't win the popular vote. I think, you know, some people have thought about the idea that, you know, John Kerry, with a shift of, you know, let's say I think it was 60,000 votes in Ohio, would have had the same thing happen to him. He would have won the presidential election and lost the popular vote. And I think people are saying that that's not really American. That's not really okay. That's not really democratic. I think also you know. People are wondering now, with so much media attention on presidential politics, they're wondering why that circus show, that television show that is presidential politics, why it doesn't come through their communities and their states. And the answer is because we have a system that is designed to only have that election waged in a select few states. We have a national election today that is now waged in a very, very few number of states, and people feel essentially disenfranchised.
Who are some of the winners and losers under the current system? I have to say that as a reporter in Wisconsin, for quite a few years, we've had it pretty good. We've met a lot of presidential candidates.
Right, and I think that's a fair question. You know, sure, swing states, Ohio, Wisconsin, even Colorado, which is becoming more of a swing state, these are the states that I guess you could say would lose, although I wouldn't put it in those terms. I think they wouldn't be as disproportionately important as they are today in the presidential election. However, here's the flip side of it. You know, places would then be equalized. A town in Wisconsin that was 40,000, that had 40,000 voters, let's say, would be as important as a town in Florida that had 40,000 voters in a presidential general election. And then you extrapolate that out. You know, let's talk about, you know, Texas, right? You know, a town in Texas that has 100,000 voters and that never sees a presidential candidate because Texas has been considered reliably Republican for years now. You know, that town of 100,000 in Texas would see both parties' candidates come through there, probably, or at least both parties' candidates treat that town as important as a town of 100,000 in Ohio. What it does is it severs the connection between your vote and your geography. Your vote is the importance of your vote is not contingent on where you live. It's a vote is a vote is a vote, which is the fundamental democratic ideal.
One person, one vote.
That's right.
David Sirota is our guest this hour, a former campaign strategist, and we're talking about his column. He is also a syndicated columnist these days. He wrote a column called The Path to a National Popular Vote, and he's got a plan, and we're talking about it this hour. We'd like you to join in as well, and we'll be taking your calls after this break. Here's our phone number. It is 800-642-1234. If you're calling from the Madison area, 263-1890. You can also join us by email, and our address is talk@wpr.org. Let us know what you think about the idea of one person, one vote, and whether it's a system we can really get to. David has talked a little bit about his plan, and we'd like to know whether you think it'll actually work. 800-642-1234. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm filling in for Joy Cardine this morning here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 20 minutes past 8 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You heard the promotion there for Kathleen Dunn. I had this note that she will be broadcasting live today from the Iowa caucuses. After 9, she'll be talking with Iowa Senator Tom Harkin, as well as some candidates and their representatives. That's coming up on Kathleen Dunn after 9 o'clock this morning. This hour, we are also talking about elections and what we're calling the path to a national popular vote. David Sirota is our guest, a former campaign strategist and author and a syndicated columnist. And we're talking about his column where he lays out a plan where we could get back to one person and one vote. Let's find out what listeners think. Chris is with us from Madison. And good morning, Chris.
Good morning, and thank you for this talk. As your guest said, there is a problem. I just disagree with his analysis. The real problem is that most people don't understand what federalism is anymore, and that it was one person, one vote in your state. And the reason why our federal government is actually national government, I should say, our general government has been doing a lot of things that annoy people is because our states aren't standing up to it anymore. And you used to be able to send people from your state and your local area to sway the national government in two different ways. And we've gotten away from that. And so now the federal government basically does what it wants and tells the states what to do. And they just keep taking more and more of our money. And what I'm afraid is the popular thing that you're talking about sounds good intuitively, one person, one vote. But where you live makes a big difference in many things. It makes a difference what jobs you take and what places you work and the people you meet and marry and stuff like that. And so if you want to really have important votes, then you move to Montana. But if you want to influence more people, then you move to Florida. So I don't see how that is a big deal at that point. So I would just push back a little bit and say that maybe we need to re-educate the American people about what federalism is and what it can do for you if your states really stand up to the national government.
Chris, thanks for the call. And David Sirota, there you go, somebody who thinks there is a problem but isn't convinced by your solution.
Well, I think we're talking about two different issues here. You know, I think that whether you believe in a national popular vote is separate from whether you believe that the country is suffering from a usurpation of federalism. I think we need a national popular vote. I think we can use our state legislatures, our state's federalist powers to create that national popular vote. And I also think the caller is right that we do have a problem in this country where the federal government has usurped much of the state's power. I'm on the board of an organization called the Progressive State Network, which works to support state legislators, and I think the caller is absolutely right. I think part of the problem is not just that states haven't stood up, but the other side of the coin, although that is a problem, the other side of the coin is that the federal government has literally legally usurped states' powers. It has preempted states from legislating in certain areas. It has usurped state power, and I think that's a huge problem. I don't think that one problem masks the other problem. That is, I don't think that there's a mutual exclusion to these two issues. I think that, in fact, it's the other way around. That one of the ways states can stand up to federal usurpation through the Electoral College, one of the ways states can stand up to that is by using state legislatures, using states' vested power to apportion Electoral College votes as they see fit to create a national popular vote in the presidential election.
Now, in your column, you say that the public is clamoring for this kind of fix, but I have to say, I haven't heard a lot about it here in Wisconsin.
Well, I think the public is clamoring for a national popular vote. I mean, I think, you know, polls show that the public fundamentally doesn't like the idea that we don't really have a one-person, one-vote system in our national presidential elections. This fix, using state legislatures to form a compact in apportioning their electoral college votes for the national popular vote winner, is a relatively new legislative idea. So I think that the reason it's such an important idea, and it has passed in Maryland, and it has passed a few other state legislative chambers. Maryland has actually passed into law. The reason I think this is a very, very important idea is because it doesn't require a constitutional amendment. Constitutional amendment's very difficult to pass. You know, you have to pass it in most state legislatures. You got to get a huge vote in Congress for it. This idea, the national popular vote, you know, state legislatures, you know, if you get enough states that represent 273 or 272 electoral college votes to do this, you automatically have a national popular vote. I mean, you could literally, after the 2008 legislative sessions, which start in which are starting right now, we could have a national popular vote for president in this 2008 election, theoretically. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but it could be done very, very quickly.
Let's go to back to the phones right now, and Richard is with us from Nina. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I guess first I'd like to agree with a lot of things that Chris said. If you go back to when the Constitution was written, or as the Constitution is today, it was not intended to be one person, one vote. You said there was a fundamental aspect of democracy. Well, it's not according to the U.S. Constitution. The idea was that each of the states were represented, and in fact, the first state to sign to ratify the Constitution was Delaware, and the last was Rhode Island. The two smallest states were very concerned about being represented at a national level, and that's why the smaller states are that's why the vote is biased toward the smaller states, because you get vote in the electoral college equal to your number of representatives plus senators. If I were running for president, I'd campaign in New York City area and Los Angeles and, Houston and whatever the largest cities in the country are.
You mean if it was a popular vote?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And I'd totally ignore the plains and the Midwest and large swatches of the country. I'd totally ignore. At least this way, they get some representation.
It's interesting that you bring up Rhode Island and Delaware, of course, because those states are completely ignored in presidential elections by virtue of the problem that I've laid out, which is a winner-take-all system, and the only states that count are the ones that are very, very closely divided. Additionally, small states, small electoral college states, are not actually well represented in the electoral college. That is, because the electoral college is related to population, those small states do not have very good representation in the electoral college. I don't necessarily think that last tenet is a bad thing, because I believe in you know, one person, one vote. To your point about, you know, candidates campaigning would only campaign in cities, I think there's some argument to be made that could be a problem. However, so much of the country right now is totally ignored. Totally and completely ignored. The Midwest, the Plains states, so many of those states, so many regions are completely ignored that I think it would be a better situation where a town of 50,000 people in a place like Kansas would be as important to presidential candidates as a town of 50,000 people in Ohio and in Florida and anywhere else. That's my fundamental belief. I agree with you that the Constitution has been set up undemocratically. I absolutely agree, but I don't think that's a good thing. I don't think by the virtue of the fact that the Constitution was written by the Founding Fathers and there is undemocratic principles in there, that should be okay with people. And as I said, polls show that the public is not okay with that kind of undemocratic situation.
And Richard, I heard you trying to get in there.
Well, I was just going to say, you talk about a town of 50,000 people and, well, wherever. I'd go to a neighborhood in Brooklyn where you have apartment complexes. that have 50,000 people, and then go half a mile away to another 50,000 people. I'd never even consider going to the Dakotas or, you know, I mean, they're vast watches of the country.
And but candidates worse. Don't go there now. Candidates don't go there now.
And your proposal makes it worse because the lightly populated areas, at least with the Electoral College, at least the vote is biased towards them slightly.
Well, I actually would just close by saying I think that the fact that John Edwards is competing in Iowa through winning or having major support in Iowa's rural areas, it's a small microcosm, but it proves, I think, your point wrong. The idea that this would, some candidates would be rural candidates. Some candidates could be suburban candidates. Some candidates could be urban candidates. Just because you've laid out a situation that could happen doesn't mean that that situation would happen. The national popular vote system would open it up to different kinds of candidacies. There could be a candidate who said, look, I'm not going to win in the big cities, but I think I have an appeal in small-town America, and I can now go out and campaign in small-town America without worrying that a given number of small towns are in states that don't matter in the Electoral College.
I want to return for a moment to your column, because we talk about the proposal where the states could take the initiative here and change some things. And then later on in the column, you talk about something I wasn't aware of, a ballot initiative in California that would change things. And in your estimation, they make it seem like a good thing, but in your estimation, it's actually a bad thing.
Right. What they were going to put on the ballot in California was an initiative to essentially break the state into 53 different individual states. I think it's 52 or 53 congressional districts that California has. And basically what it would say is that the Electoral College votes of California would be apportioned by whoever won each congressional district. So if you won a congressional district, you would get that congressional district's one Electoral College vote. And this was being proposed under the guise of this is more representative, this is more democracy. Except the obvious problem with it is first and foremost, it was pushed by Republican operatives, and it would automatically mean about 20 or 23 Republican Electoral College votes without the Republicans doing anything in California. The second problem with it is, of course, is that when one state does that and the other states don't do it, it gives one party a particular advantage, as I described. The same Republicans who are pushing that ballot initiative in California, of course, weren't pushing that ballot initiative in places like Texas or North Carolina or Georgia, where the advantage would be to Democrats. And finally, the most important point of all is that apportioning presidential Electoral College votes by congressional district, essentially breaking the country into 435 separate states within the Electoral College system, would actually increase the possibility that we would get a president elected a president would be appointed without winning the national popular vote. George Bush's his Electoral College margin of victory would have been bigger in 2000 under a congressional district plan than it was under the state-based plan, even though he still would have lost the national popular vote. And finally, one last point is that if you have a congressionally appointed apportioned system, it actually micro-targets where candidates would think to go. In other words, right now we have a system where candidates only go to a certain number of states. The congressional district plan would allow it to micro-target even further. Only the congressional districts that were closely divided would candidates really go to. So you'd have candidates not just going to states, they'd only be going to certain individual communities with the rest of those states and the whole country left out.
And in California, your column says that the GOP couldn't quite agree on it, and so it sort of died under its own weight. But you also say in the same sentence that it'll be back.
Absolutely. I mean, any plan that gives the Republicans a way to essentially steal 20 or 21, 22 Electoral College votes without doing anything, I think is going to be back because the Republicans are pretty ruthless political operators. And of course, the the advantage for them on that is that Western states like California tend to have easier ballot access. So it's easier to get something on the ballot like that than in the other states where if Democrats put it on the ballot, it would advantage them in the same way. So I think that California plan is definitely going to be back, and I think the way to avoid that, for all of the reasons that I've laid out, the idea that it benefits only one party, the idea that it actually could decrease democracy even further, I think the way to combat that is for our states to move to this national popular vote plan in state legislatures to finally make our system one where we guarantee that the candidate who gets the most votes in the national election becomes the president.
Let's go back to the phones right now, and Patrick is with us from Concord. Hi, Patrick.
Yes, good morning. I totally agree with your presenter today in the fact that there's also some other issues that are even deeper in that. If you remember Ross Perot,
I do.
Yeah, he got about, what, 20% of the popular vote?
I don't remember.
Oh, yeah.
He did pretty well,
right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, it was pretty high percentage, but yet at the same time, you saw kind of a rallying in the fact that there wasn't enough independents in the Electoral College, and you saw the Republican and the Democratic Party get very nervous at the fact that a third party could actually come along.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we haven't even touched on the idea that the current system essentially completely disenfranchises third parties. I mean, you're right. Ross Perot got 19% of the vote and got no Electoral College votes. I mean, if you want to have a very simple way to understand how the Electoral College vote disenfranchises millions and millions of Americans, 20 million Americans voted for Ross Perot and had no representation at all in the national in the Electoral College results.
Mm-hmm. And one other thing that you hear quite frequently is, well, you know, a vote for so-and-so is actually a vote for this other party because he'll never win, and that takes away from the guy who's going to win.
Yeah,
you're
absolutely right, and I didn't even mention that. You're absolutely right. The other way that the current system disincentivizes third-party candidates is it increases the credibility of the quote unquote spoiler argument. If you have a national popular vote, let's put it this way: Ross Perot back in 1992, you could very well argue that he spoiled many, many states for George Bush. Many states that Bill Clinton won and that were key to him winning the presidential election. In fact, most of the states that made up President Clinton's margin of victory in 1992 were states that were traditionally Republican, where Ross Perot performed very well, cut into George H.W. Bush's margins, and delivered those states to Bill Clinton. And the essential thing is that those states, after Perot didn't run the next couple of elections, those states went back to being Republicans. But the problem is, I mean, I would submit that the problem was, is that the Electoral College sort of emboldened that. Now, I'm glad President Clinton became the president because I'm a Democrat, but I don't think it's a good thing that the Electoral College helped skew that situation, where it helped further quote unquote spoil an election, as opposed to having simply tallying who wins the national popular vote. And I mean, Clinton still would have won, but you're absolutely right. The point is that it increases this pressure to not have third party candidates because that the Electoral College increases the spoiler phenomenon.
And you know, when you talk about the solution, though, I mean, you're still going to have within the state legislators, those are partisans, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, who are going to be voting on this. And Maryland is certainly one thing, but there are a lot of other states that you know have a lot to lose in terms of prestige, in terms of political influence. And I would see it to be a difficult thing to have a prominent Democrat or a prominent Republican vote for this because it may not be in their best political interests.
Look, I can see your argument there, except here's the thing, is that the states that are currently disenfranchised by the current system have far more Electoral College votes than the states that benefit from the current system. And here's the thing, through state legislatures, because this plan can be passed through state legislatures, there is no it's hard to imagine a state legislator from, well, just use Maryland. Maryland, those state legislators represent, you know, different districts in Maryland that don't get any attention from the presidential process. They're disenfranchised from the presidential process. So those state legislatures, those state legislators, their incentive is for this plan in the states that are currently disenfranchised. And so, and as I said, there's many more states that are disenfranchised than that are not disenfranchised. So I would say to you that the political incentive for the people who can actually pass this plan, the majority of the people who can either pass or reject this plan, the thousands of state legislators across the country, the majority of those people, because the majority of states are disenfranchised by the current plan, the majority of those legislators have an incentive to pass this plan because it would benefit the majority of them and the majority of their constituents.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with David Sirota this hour, a former campaign strategist, and we're talking about a column. He's also a syndicated columnist these days, a column called The Path to a National Popular Vote. And he is arguing for the idea of one person, one vote. And we'd like to know what you think. 800-642-1234. We'll be taking your calls right after this break. You're on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 18 minutes before 9 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Up after 9, Kathleen Dunn broadcasts live from the Iowa caucuses today. She'll be talking with Iowa Senator Tom Harkin, as well as other candidates and their representatives. That's Kathleen Dunn coming up after 9. This hour, we are talking about elections as well from a slightly different slant, talking about the path to a national popular vote. David Sirota is our guest, former campaign strategist and author of a couple of books, including Hostile Takeover, How Big Business Took Over Our Government and How We Can Take It Back. His next book, The Uprising, is going to be published later this year in May. Let's get back to the phones right now, and Bill joins us, and Bill is in Deerfield. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning, Gene. Good morning, David. I agree. I think that the vote should be a national popular vote. I think it's crazy. In 2004, you had New Mexico decided by a few hundred votes, and basically half the state got disenfranchised. And take a state like Wisconsin, which is nearly 50-50. Half of us, regardless of who wins, half of us are going to be disappointed that our vote basically doesn't count. But unless I misunderstood, David, you said that small states are less powerful. I always thought that congressional representation is based on population. So say you have Wyoming, you get one congressman, but then you get two senators, and if you do the math and divide it up, your vote is actually more heavily weighted than a vote in California, where those two senators have to be divided up between tens of millions of people.
Yes, no, you're right mathematically. I mean, you're absolutely right. What I was saying was that because the Electoral College is at least related to population, many small states just don't have much representation. I mean, Delaware and Rhode Island don't have very much representation within the entire Electoral College. Now, they might have their representation is slightly weighted higher because they have two senators. But the point is that the argument that the current system is automatically good for small states, I think, is just not borne out. And by the previous caller's citation of Delaware and Rhode Island, I mean, Delaware and Rhode Island are two very small states which are completely ignored in presidential elections. So all I was trying to say is that, you know, this is not necessarily a small state or big state issue. I mean, look, the most important states in the current Electoral College situation in America are Ohio and Florida, two of the biggest states. This is not a small state versus little state thing. Small state versus big state thing. This is a question of whether your vote's importance should be tied to your geography, whether your vote should be more important because you live in a certain state, or less important because you live in another state, or whether you believe that a vote should be important, as important, no matter where you live.
Right. Can I say one more thing?
Sure.
Okay, the situation in California, that is now being privately funded. They are gathering signatures, And what they're doing is they're gathering signatures for a referendum that has to do with hospital access. So it looks really, really positive. But when you read down on the small print, it also throws on this proportionality issue.
That's right, and that's actually why I said it. I think this pernicious ballot initiative is going to come back. It's going to come back in probably in some other Western states also, because Western states have easier ballot access laws to put on things that seem to do one thing and do an exact opposite thing. The California ballot initiative on the Electoral College is a perfect example of an initiative that seems like it's a pro-democracy initiative. Oh, we'll make our Electoral College votes a little bit more proportional. We won't do winner-take-all. Except, as I've described, it actually would increase the chance that a president would be appointed who didn't win the national popular vote, a less democratic reform.
So how would your idea play in California?
Well, my idea, I mean, you know, if California passed this national popular vote legislation like Maryland did, it would not go into effect until there were enough states that had passed the same legislation
right. That
represented a majority of votes. I mean, that's the big red herring that people throw out there. Is that, oh, you know, if we apportion our votes to the national popular vote winner before everyone else does, then we're basically throwing away our votes. Well, again, this doesn't go into effect until enough electoral college votes do that. And so what would happen with California is California would, if they passed this bill, again, it wouldn't start until other states did it. But let's say the system existed. What would happen is California right now is not entirely ignored, because sometimes Republicans think they can win the presidential, the general election in California. Usually not. California is largely ignored in the presidential election. Now you'd have Republican candidates would have an interest in coming to California and campaigning in California. Democratic candidates would have an interest in coming and campaigning there as well to try to defend and try to win the state. The state's cities, the state's suburban communities. Right now, both parties ignore California. So this would be good for a state like California.
Let's head over to Viroqua right now, and Leland is with us. Good morning.
Good morning. I appreciate you having this issue on the radio, because I've heard very little of it in the last 30 years of my voting life. And I've been one of those people out there saying one person, one vote, or one man, one vote for a long time. I think it's time to get rid of the Electoral College, and I wonder what Mr. Sirota thinks about that idea. And I mean, being as it was initially brought about to bring about fairer representation of states, and also I was wondering about the issue that when Florida became the swing state in 2000, I believe George Bush's brother was the governor.
That's right.
And thus another inside track to political influence in a national election comes about when family members, friends, or even people owed favors are heading up larger or smaller states that have some power to elect, you know, that person.
That's a very good point. Is that what you're saying is that under a national popular vote system there would be much less ability for finagling at different levels of government over the national election result. In other words, there would be less chance that a national election could be manipulated by officials at lower levels of government. If the national popular vote winner is the winner of the election, it's much harder for a governor or a state's secretary of state to to take actions that actually really affect or in that case change the winner of the election. To your point about eliminating the Electoral College, well, I don't think that's a bad idea. The problem is that, as I said from the beginning, passing a constitutional amendment is very, very difficult. Very, very difficult. There hasn't been one passed in years. And so what this state-based legislation would do is allow the national popular vote to a national popular vote system to be created without having to go through the arduous and often impossible task of passing a constitutional amendment. We can have the effect of not having an electoral college without having to pass a constitutional amendment eliminating the electoral college.
John from Onalaska is up next. Good morning.
Hello. Yes, thank you. Yes, I guess I haven't thought this through completely, but I have a very strong worry about basically your proposal. And my biggest worry in government today is the tyranny of the majority. I mean, the Christian right has kind of awakened me to that. I see that in Iraq they're trying to form a government. They're primarily worrying about protecting the different groups. The dissolution of, say, of Great Britain, where people in more, it's sort of happening around the world, people want more regional autonomy. And I think that's what the purpose of this Electoral College system was to give the states power. I worry about the tyranny of the majority, and I don't think I want a total, complete democracy because of that. I want safety valves to prevent the tyranny of the majority. Would you comment on that?
Sure. I think that the system we have right now is more of a tyranny of the majority than we would have under a national popular vote by virtue of the fact that in most states, that in every state, the winner-take-all electoral college system means that the minority has no representation whatsoever, nothing. If a presidential candidate wins a state with 51% of the vote, 49%, and gets all of that state's electoral college votes, then 49% of that state's voters have just been tyrannized. They have no representation whatsoever. And so what a national popular vote system would do within the context of the election is say that the minority in different states has their votes count. Their votes are important. You know, in Texas, this is a state, again, this is a state that is ignored by both parties because the Republicans have been winning it with, 58, 59, 60% of the vote. Well, why should 40% of Texas, one of the biggest states in the country, why should 40% of those voters have absolutely no representation in the national election system? It's absolutely ludicrous. And to me, within the context of the election, that is the epitome of a tyranny of the majority. When the winner by one vote, 50 plus one, gets 100% of the votes. I think that is a tyranny of the majority.
Let's move on now. We've got lots of calls coming in. Will joins us from Madison. Hi, Will.
Yes, hi. I was raised in Baltimore, where the importance of voting was stressed to youth, and began voting at the age of 18 and continue to do so. Now I'm in my mid-40s. But after living some years in the 90s in the state of Georgia, it became distressing to me to see the whole redistricting, I think that's the word for it, of the voting provinces. And what was happening was a lot of educated minorities, college-educated minorities, were moving into Atlanta and the surrounding counties. So it became, it seems, an intelligent strategy of the Republican Party to redraw all the lines so that what used to be known as a very solid Democratic base became splintered. And that really frustrates voters like me. And I just wonder if you wanted to comment on that. And secondly, what can I do as John Doe voter to assist you in this type of push?
Both very good questions. The redistricting process would not affect the national popular vote situation, insofar as the current debate is about should electoral college votes be apportioned by state or by a national popular vote
state lines are not redrawn. You're absolutely right that within the context of state legislative and local elections and congressional elections, that the redrawing of lines to benefit one or another political party has been a huge, huge problem. How you can help pass a national popular vote, it's pretty simple. You can get in touch with your state legislators, and you can ask them to sponsor this plan in your state legislature. You can tell them to go to the Progressive States Network. It's www.progressivestates.org, or just Google National Popular Vote. There's a group that pushes, that works only on this issue. And you can ask your state legislators to work with those groups to move this in their legislature. And you know, I think that the thing is, as I said before, the incentive here for most legislators is to say, you know, yes, I support this. Now, in Wisconsin, I agree. You know, there's going to be a debate. There'll be, some legislators will say, look, I like it that Wisconsin is a swing state and therefore gets, in the general election, disproportionate attention. There's going to be that debate. But I think I think even within the context of Wisconsin, right? I mean, let's just talk about the context of Wisconsin. I'm guessing, and I don't know this for sure, but I'm guessing that many presidential candidates focus specifically only on the largest population centers in Wisconsin because those are the ones that most impact the final statewide total. Okay? Under a national popular vote system, smaller towns in Wisconsin become just as important as smaller towns in other, even more contested states like Ohio. You know, if you meet 100,000 voters in the small towns of Wisconsin, that's as important as meeting 100,000 voters in Canton, Ohio. So I think there is a case to be made beyond just the one person, one vote, even in a swing state, that this could open up the election process to parts of swing states that aren't really paid attention to.
In the 45 seconds or so we have remaining, what are the odds that we're going to see this in the near future?
I think this is a couple year process to be realistic about it. You know, I think, you know, this idea is relatively new. Maryland was the first legislature to pass it. As I said, other legislative chambers have passed it. So I think this is going to take time. But I think this is a very realistic plan. And as I said, I think there are enough states that have an incentive to do this that are currently ignored in the current process that this is going to move, this is going to pass, and this is ultimately going to end the situation whereby we live in what's called the greatest democracy on earth, yet have a system that very easily allows for somebody to become president while losing the national popular vote.
Well, David Sirota, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. David Sirota, a former campaign strategist, author of a couple of books, including Hostile Takeover, How Big Businesses Took Over Our Government and How We Can Take It Back. He wrote a recent syndicated columnist, The Path to a National Popular Vote. He is published, by the way, by Creators Syndicate, and his column appears in a number of papers, including the Denver Post, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Seattle Times, and others. Leo Duran produced this hour. We had on-air production from Christina Taylor. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm filling in for Joy Cardine. I'll be here for the rest of this week, such as it is, and I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.